Christmas! Where's all of my praises? I want everybody around the world to put your hands together because all the praise belongs to God. Here we go.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to find out how viruses actually work. A primer. This will be a series of Classroom on the Air. And we're going to be sharing insights specifically from a scientist from Stanford University who will give us step-by-step on everything about viruses. His name is Professor Bruce Goldman. Also today, we're going to share a segment from Tucker Carlson's show last evening. As you know, I would agree with some things Tucker suggests and guests he has on, and I would be on the opposite end of that debate on many others. But what I do like about Tucker is he's not afraid to allow freedom of speech with contrasting points of view. And it's for we, the audience, to decide if either or neither or both have something of merit. When censorship is rampant within corporate media, liberal media, and conservative media. So what we need to do is gain little insights. And last night was a big insight. I wouldn't have known this. No one else in America that I'm aware of had this story that 3M Corporation, a major Fortune 500 corporation, one of the largest, if not the largest, makers of these health masks, these protective masks that doctors, nurses, paramedics, police, firefighters, the people who are on the front line who should be protected, are not getting the mask. Some masks are being worn for a week in contaminated environments. And ironic, they don't even know how to clean a mask, because they never had to. In fact, my accountant in New York, when I was going over, as I do every single day, proper protocols so that nobody starts to get laxed, and I said, when you go home and you're on a subway, what precautions are you taking? When you get home, do you leave your shoes outside? And my accountant, Gary, says, I've been into health for decades. My wife's a nurse, and we both follow the same principles. We eat a healthy diet, lots of organic food. We take all the right supplements. He said, I have all my vitamin D and C and E, and I take my astragalus. And he says, everything in our apartment, everything is cleaned at least 10 times a day. We wipe everything down. We change our clothes when we get home, wash them before sitting down so it doesn't spread from our clothes if we should have something on. He says, yeah. And I said, well, good for you. But how many other people don't do that and therefore take their contaminated clothes from a hospital back home and then it's spread around their home when they don't have a mask? Now, mind you, none of these people have any kind of ionizer. None of these people have air purifiers in their home. So they're vulnerable and they're on the front lines. We should really be concerned about their health because many of them have sacrificed their lives and have died because of being in the front line. I have enormous respect for first responders in all areas. So what I saw was the head of FEMA in Florida telling Tucker they're making up to 10 million masks a week and we can't buy any of them. Where are they going? To China and other countries? Why aren't they allowing people in the United States to buy masks? Why aren't they allowing the government to buy masks? Because they're jacking up the prices sometimes 10 times, that's 1,000% above what they should be charging. It's all about greed. So this is on 3M. Now, because it was made public, there's a very good possibility this guy loses his job. Because in governmental agencies, it's a very strict confidentiality agreement you have to sign, that any problem you have to push it up the scale in your area, not outside, inside. So good for him for having the courage to come forward and tell us the public honest truth. So I'm going to play that for you. So set aside your politics about liking or disliking Tucker or him being on Fox. He told the truth and no one else did. So we're going to bring you the truth wherever it comes from, even if we hold contrary points of view, and rightly so, on other issues. Also today, since we've been doing a lot of heavy lifting on topics, let's pull back a bit and see if we can gain any insights, anything that triggers an intelligent response to what a person is going to say. I have a guest. She's not live, but she was being interviewed. She's a well-known and highly respected British journalist. Her name is Melanie Phillips. She's a broadcaster. She's a best-selling author. She has a weekly column, which currently appears in the Times of London, the most respected paper on the planet. She also has been published over the years in The Guardian, The Observer, Sunday Times, all good publications. And she also writes for the Jewish Chronicle and the Jewish News Syndicate. And she's a popular panelist on BBC's radio, The Moral Maze, and she speaks on public platforms throughout the English-speaking world. And what I do that relaxes me, actually, late at night, after I've tended all the chores and done all my counseling and work, I see if there's something that can stimulate a different perspective. And she did an interview entitled, Why I Left the Left. Now, mind you, this was a highly respected feminist liberal voice for a long time, decades. And now she's given it up and walked away. Why, she explains, should we be paying attention? Should we examine our own lives, either conservative or liberal or independent, and see, does this resonate? If it doesn't resonate, let it go. But if it does, it opens up a way of thinking. So, something different today that I thought you might find of interest. We always begin, however, with the latest on health and healing. And from Mount Sinai Hospital comes a new article published in the peer-reviewed journal Stem Cell Reports that nicotinamide, a form of vitamin B3, can inhibit aggressive cell transformations during wound healing and may be a key to the development of therapies to treat any form of eye disease that impairs vision. So, that's important. Fibrotic eye diseases are very common, and they mitigate vision loss with this nutrient. So, just something, a little extra, another little piece of the puzzle, because the researchers found that this nicotinamide not only inhibits these cell transformations, which are bad, when they manifest, but can also reverse that cell transition and slow down the development of eye diseases that would otherwise lead to vision loss or blindness. So helping people with their vision, yeah. Helping stop the loss of vision, that's terrific. And something as simple as a nutrient, a vitamin B3. So, that's good. From King's College London comes a report published in Communications Biology, a journal. And what it's saying is, when you decide to make healthy lifestyle changes, that in and of itself can delay memory problems. And it's all about the genes that are impacted. That's the lay language bottom line. So go to a healthy plant-based diet and you're going to live a longer life with a healthier brain, better memory, better cognition, and be less susceptible to dementia, Alzheimer's, and other conditions. So right now we are having a lot of research all over the world on ways of increasing our life expectancies. But beyond creating life expectancies, I believe we should be focused on something that is not being dealt with. That's why we're doing this study right now. and that is, how do we prevent diseases that otherwise are considered normal for aging but are not? They're normal for our lifestyles. And if our lifestyles and our life choices are not healthy and create inflammatory responses that lead to heart disease and diabetes, etc., then if we can change those, then no matter how long we live, we're living healthier. And when you're healthier and not focused upon the dread of disease and medications and hospitalization, that gives you a better quality of life. So then what if you can do both? What if you're able to prevent diseases that others take for granted? Well, I'm a certain age, you know, it's normal to be diabetic or have heart disease, everybody I know does, and instead say, I chose a different path, and because of the path I chose, I don't have any diseases, and I'm not my chronological age. I'm 30 years younger, and by the way, there are actual biological tests that can determine the telomere length and how old you are at a biological level. And I've even shared in a recent lecture, which is going to go up today or a Monday, on how you can slow down biological aging. And this is for everyone, not just people at home who are doing this study. But now you do two things, two positives. A, you don't have the diseases because you're preventing them. And B, you're going to live a longer life because your biological age is going to be longer by what you're doing. So the very protocols that prevent disease are the same protocols that extend the lifespan. That's what this is about. In fact, in about 20 minutes, assuming some people can stop their exercising and come into the staff kitchen and pick up a phone, Jesse is going to have whoever is available. And I just want you to see, what have people learned since getting here just in the last couple of weeks? Because you sometimes think, gee whiz, it took me so long to go through high school and college, and those who went post-college into fellowships. Do you really want to do more? You know, you've got it. Why continue? In fact, most people don't. You would not believe how few people read a nonfiction book per year, one per year. It's an infinitesimal part of the American population. In fact, many people don't read any books except popular novels. So we need to continue learning. And all I do here, just so you understand, is I've had 37 lectures I've given. And only one has been about health. Just one. And that wasn't because of these people. It's because of all the people at home who says, we'd like to know something too. Okay, happy to share it. But we're going to find out, what have they learned that is impacting their health? You see, I never start with a symptom. I never start with the end-stage tumor mass. I start with what caused it. What in your lifestyle, what in your environment? Because if you deal with it at that level, you're not only changing the outcome of that disease, but all other diseases can be impacted or mitigated because you're changing what you're feeding. Feed a fire, and it's going to burn. So that's what we're talking about. And by the way, there are other previous studies that indicate that neural stem cells in the hippocampal part of your brain play an important role in the decline of our thought processes and memory over time. So the neural stem cells are cells that keep dividing as long as they are alive and either make more of the neurostem cells or cells that have a specialist function in the brain. And the maintenance of these neurostem cells is important in memory and is affected by the environmental factors like your diet, potato chips, french fries, hot dogs and pizzas and soft drinks and coffee and colas. Whether you're doing that or a healthy plant-based diet with the nuts and the nut butters and the good oils, if you're exercising versus sedentary, all that can now be explained, leading to the variation in how aging affects different people. The trouble is, we kind of play a game. We either don't care about health at all, that's the vast majority of people, and that's by the actual diseases we have. So people can give you a statistic, oh, well, I'm okay, I'm making healthy choices, and then you look at them, and they're not. And remember, you are what you do, not just what you say. Or people are making healthy choices, and you see it. So we have to decide, how healthy do we want to be? How happy do we want to be? How free do we want to be? How creative, how passionate about life? Finally, from a Budasu Chi Medical Foundation, which is in Taiwan, they did a study that was published in a peer-reviewed journal of complementary therapies and clinical practice that acupuncture can improve quality of life. In this case, it was chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. You'll know it as COPD. It's a disease caused by inflammation of the lining of the bronchial tubes, which let air in and out of the lungs. And this inflammation obstructs airflow from the organ, causing a variety of symptoms such as cough, mucus production, wheezing, and difficulty breathing. And these symptoms all lead to poor health-related quality of life, and they can't exercise. But this new study shows that when you use acupuncture therapy, it can improve the ability to get back into health. So it's important. Just one more thing that we can add. One more piece of the puzzle. Oh, and by the way, from Hadash Mount Scopus Hospital in Israel comes a study that increasing your vitamin D will reduce pulmonary exacerbations in patients with cystic fibrosis. Now, that's important. That's it on health today. I'll do more, of course, tomorrow. But I want to tie a couple things together, as I did yesterday. First, understand that many of the studies that we're relying upon to determine how severe the spread of coronavirus is, according to this latest study, 50%, that's 50% of COVID-19 tests can give false positive results. And this is from a Whitefield from CDC, quote, a Chinese study shows that COVID-19 tests can produce false positive test results. 50% or more of the tests are suspected to produce incorrect results. The study's been published in PubMed and ResearchGate. Information has not been commented on in the media. These are so-called false positive test results, which means that the patients who have been tested and informed that they have been infected with COVID-19 are not really infected at all or have been infected by some other infection. The false positive results and screenings have not been reported in the media by authorities. And then it goes into this. Well, think of the consequences if you have a false positive. First of all, the stress of that would be terrible. Now go back to what I said yesterday. In Italy, of the 12,400 deaths, the average age of a person dying was around 77 years of age. Worldwide, it's around 80 years. But most importantly, there were multiple cofactors. And this included emphysema from smoking, heavy, heavy smoking, and heart disease, and COPD, cancers. So these people, for all intents and purposes, would have died, the vast majority, of those conditions, and would have been reported based upon what the primary pathology was. Put in the coronavirus, and suddenly that tips it over to a fatality. Yet 100% of the credit goes to the virus and none of it to these other diseases, these comorbidity conditions. That's bad science. That is deceptive science, in my opinion. Do we have a crisis? Yes. Is this a serious condition? Yes. Will this kill people? Yes. Should we take every possible precaution with self-isolation and proper hygiene at every level? Yes, yes, yes. So that's bad enough. But then panicking the people as if somehow this is the end of times and we're all going to die, that's not legitimate. So let us bring reason. Let us bring good and accurate science. Let us bring proper public health science so that we do not cause a lot of people don't have it because of false positives and be treated. Now, that's one. But separately, there is another study today that maps, this is from Scientific America, quote, map reveals hidden U.S. hotspots for coronavirus infections. By adjusting for population, researchers have identified rural areas in several states that could be disproportionately affected by COVID-19 virus. Okay. Now, here's what they found. That currently we have about 203,000 cases of coronavirus throughout all of America, and New York City has emerged as the number one place in the world. All right. About 44,900, according to this, have tested positive. First of all, what test did they use? Since many of the tests are not accurate, did they use the best test, a PCR test? We don't know. Then they say that there are major outbreaks now in rural areas. And then they're taking a look and saying this was done at the University of Chicago, the mapping. And they're finding in Arkansas, in Georgia, and Mississippi. And then specifically you go down into those areas. And I've been to all these areas many, many times. And doing documentaries like Poverty Inc. and on the poor health of people. And what you find is that there's three things that are not accounted for in this study. One, when you get down into Macon, Georgia, and you get in some of these small communities, people tend to do things together. And they tend not to be engaging in the principle of caution, or what is called the cautionary principle. So they're less likely, up to this recently, to have worn masks, to have engaged in wearing gloves, to have sanitized and sterilized as much as possible their house, to have, you know, alcohol or disinfectant wipes that are known to kill the virus. And by the way, drinking alcohol does not disinfect this virus. It's not high enough in its alcohol content. You got to get up there. And rubbing alcohol up around 80, 90%, yeah, that'll kill it. And diluted bleach will kill it, hydrogen peroxide. So there are some viruses and bacteria that are easily killed. Others are more challenging. So we should be having the government put out daily and demanded on all media, here are the things that will you can do that can kill the virus if it's on a surface. Here are the here's how you wash your hands, for how long. The things that people could do. Here's how you can make your own makeshift masks if you don't have a mask and can't get one. We're not doing that. We're not doing any of the above. We have failed miserably on this. Hopefully we might learn something. The government's not going to learn anything. They're incapable. You can learn from it. But then what you're not taking into account is these people are the unhealthiest people in America. Go back, for those of you who listen regularly to this program, and remember about 2 years ago I did a program on where in America are people having the shortest lifespans and then why. And not using statistics which can be dry and biased or limited by design. I go into these places. I interview the people. I talk with them. When I wanted to know what had happened to my hometown of Parkersburg, 10 years ago, I took my camera crew too, and I filmed, walked up and down the streets I grew up on. Many of the people were still alive, and my neighbors were still alive. They were in their 80s. But it was a wonderful set of interviews. Now went back, and my entire town is a ghetto. My entire town looks like a ghettoed area of Detroit, even though Detroit's bouncing back, and good for them. I'm glad to see it. And other areas are bouncing back, but not altogether. It's only bouncing back where they've gentrified it and pushed people who were poor to begin with into a poor situation. But be that as it may, I had to walk down every street, and I mean literally for 5.5 hours when I got off the plane, I walked down in streets, going up, knocking on doors, talking with people. And they told me, yeah, everything's gone to hell here. The factory's closed. People didn't have jobs. And heroin was cheap in West Virginia. And here you have all these abandoned houses. So, and sure enough, go over to that White House. I went over with drug addicts at nighttime. My God, it's like a surreal film. About 11 o'clock at night, suddenly up on one area, Quincy Hill, the place is crawling with people, all drug addicts. So I sat on a porch with three people who lived in a house there that used to belong to a good friend of mine, and they told me all about what had happened. How did this happen? I wanted to know. But I went over and interviewed the drug addicts, lots of them, and they're not hiding. They're out in plain sight. Not a single person in my own neighborhood still lived there. They're all gone, either dead or gone. Imagine an entire town, whole town, ghettoized. So I wrote an article, and the Parkersburg Daily News published it, about what the hell happened to this once great town to grow up in, with viable working class. And afterwards, and I'm grateful that they published it because it was hard-hitting. I did not pull back any punches, my disappointment. And people flooded me with, you know, who were there growing up with me. Here's what happened. So you see, only when you go down to Macon, Georgia, and you see how people live, you see the diet, you see obesity, diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, people die of embolisms and dying far before the rest of the American population, because in these rural areas, they frequently are very provincial. That doesn't mean they're not nice, doesn't mean they're not kind people, they are. But boy, they don't change at all. And some of the dishes people were eating 100 years ago, that's what they eat. So now, on the one hand, we seem to be in a cognitive disconnect. These people are dying faster and at greater numbers, with more children with diabetes, more seniors today dying younger than what they did by measurable amount of time. So then, wouldn't it also mean that if they continue to go to church in a group and they go to cover dish dinners and they go to bars and hang out, which is a part of their tradition, that a bunch of people on a lawn doing a barbecue, you think they're going to change? They're thinking that virus is not hitting them. It's Chinese, or it's Italian, or it's, you know, it's Washington State's people. And then they're infected. Now, then we have this question we must ask and hopefully get an objective answer. Did they die of the coronavirus, or did they die of comorbidity that they had had, which was killing them? And they were in nursing homes and died, because it didn't differentiate who died at home and who died in a nursing home, a senior citizen center. I just read a report this morning that said, we can't stop the outbreak in our nursing home. Everybody's infected. In one place, 14 people died in one nursing home. But again, these numbers are not being parsed. Did a younger person die of this with no comorbidity? Okay, if so, let's put that into perspective. How many are dying because they would have died anyhow and are dying and have been dying? More people died in Georgia and Louisiana and Mississippi from obesity-related conditions like heart disease and diabetes than would have died of any other cause by population anywhere else in America. So shouldn't you put that in perspective so you're looking at the real culprit or a cofactor culprit? And we're not doing that. Not yet. Hopefully we will. So just a perspective. And finally, before we go to our break, I want to, you know, just want you to know that I'm going to be doing an article. Probably on our next program, I'll share the article. And it's going to be an article from a magazine that contacted Richard Gale and says, hey, people like your articles, and we published two of them this week, they said, but people are concerned, they're confused about what's a germ and what's the difference between Bichamp and Pasteur on the germ theory versus the terrain in which a germ thrives. So we're going to do a primer's guide for beginners on what constitutes germs, which are good, which are bad, which cause disease, which promote health, an A to Z on viruses and bacteria and germs. But in the interim, let me just take a few minutes and share some thoughts from Professor Bruce Goldman. And it involves, just let's start with the basics. What is a virus? And as the coronavirus pandemic spreads across the globe, The term virus gets a lot of airplay. But what exactly are viruses, and how do they spread? And there's a virologist, highly respected, Dr. Jen Carty at Stanford University, who gives us some insights, and we're respectful of that. For starters, by the way, let's make it really simple. Viruses are easily the most abundant life form on Earth, if you accept the proposition that they're alive. Try multiplying a billion, 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 billion by a trillion, 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 trillion. Then multiply that by 1,000, and that 10 to the 31st power, that's the mind-numbing estimate of how many individual viral particles are estimated to populate the planet. But we can't imagine that. That's outside of our perspective. We have no context for that. Is a virus a living thing? I'm asked that all the time. Well, depends. Sometimes it depends upon location. Quote, outside of a cell, a viral particle is inert. End quote. That's according to Professor Crit. On its own, it can't reproduce itself or, for that matter, produce anything at all. It's an ultimate parasite. Like a politician, a lawyer? Yeah, just like them. A news commentator? You got it. An administrator in a school system? There you have it. There's just less of them. Or you could say more charitably, viruses travel light. They only pack the baggage they absolutely need to get back into your cell or get into your cell, commander its molecular machinery, multiply and make an escape. So when it comes to viruses, there are exceptions to nearly every rule, but they do have things in common. A virus travel kit always includes a genome and a surrounding protein shell, what is called a capsid, C-A-P-S-I-D, which keeps the viral genome safe, helps the virus latch onto cells and climb inside of them, and on occasion abets its offspring's getaway. The capsid consists of identical protein subunits whose unique shapes and properties determine the capsid's structure and function, according to this study. Now, some viruses also wear greasy overcoats called envelopes, made from stolen shards of the membrane of the last cell they infected. Influenza and hepatitis C viruses are envelopes, as do coronaviruses, herpes viruses, HIV, rhinoviruses, which are responsible for most common colds, and polioviruses don't. And here's a practical takeaway. Envelope viruses particularly despise soap because it disrupts greasy membranes. Soap and water are these viruses, they're the enemy. All right? So, what does this tell us? For a virus to spread, it must first find a way into a cell. Quote, penetrating a cell's perimeter isn't easy, according to Professor Crete. Cells' outer membranes are normally tough to penetrate without some kind of special pass. But viruses have ways of tricking cells into letting them in. Typically, a portion of the viral capsid will have a strong affinity to bind with one or another protein dotting the surfaces of one of or another particular cell type. The binding of the viral capsid with that cell surface protein serves as an admission ticket, easing the virus's invasion into the cell. So these are just, a little bit of what we have to know. I don't want to go into too much of the viral genomes because if you don't have a background in genetics or sort of biology, it might be a little confusing. But let me just put it this way, and I want to thank the good work of Bruce Goldman, who was writing from Stanford University's Professor Jan Kareed, that what's the takeaway? The takeaway message is this. When you put soap on your hands, good old-fashioned soap, not antibacterial soap, I think that's dangerous and worthless, but when you rub your hands together completely so the soap is on every inch of the hand, then rub between your fingers on top and on bottom for 30 seconds. and then take your knuckles and rub it into the palm of the hand, and take your other hand's knuckles and rub it into the palm of the other hand. And all this takes at least 60 seconds, hopefully a little longer, a minute and a half, and then you rinse. And then when you rinse, don't turn off the spigot unless you already have a paper towel over it. Otherwise, you reinfect your hand. And then the whole process you just goes out the window. Don't touch a doorknob. Don't ever, under any circumstances, use one of those air blowers because they're loaded with feces, and you're throwing feces all over your hands and body and clothes. Instead, use paper towels. But even when getting a paper towel, don't just reach up there and pull down a paper towel. These are the little minutia that people don't think about, because everyone else's hands have gone up there and pulled down towels. What if they're not sterile and therefore left debris, bacteria, viruses, parasites, feces, on the outside rims where that pair? So you reach up and you pinch the paper towel and you pull the pinched paper towel out, because not every place has. Put your hand under and it automatically comes out. Simple things like that. Then put some coconut oil, because coconut oil is a great antibacterial, onto your hands. It helps your skin and it also protects you. Then put on your gloves and then wash your gloves. See, simple things we can do, because we don't need to infect ourselves or anybody else. So just some basics. I'm going to have a whole article on all this that we're writing. I'll take some time today. But now, I want to see, I'm going to ask Jesse, if you've been able to round a few of the people up. I haven't spoken with them. I'd just like to see what message they can share with this audience of what they've learned up to this point. All right? No one's called in? Well, why don't you go out and try to find, or not you, why don't you call down and see if we can't get them in there? I hope they haven't forgotten that we're at an hour difference. I'd just like for you to hear them, if not today, certainly on the next day. So what we're going to do now, we're going to go over to Tucker Carlson. And again, set aside whether you like or don't like him or the form he uses. I can assure you, I sure as hell don't like one of the forums, a Pacifica that I was on. I didn't like it so much, I quit it rather than continue to support them. PFW in Washington, I have nothing good to say about Berkeley at all. But I'm still here on WBAI as our sister station for 44 years because there's some good people here, great audience, and people trying their best to be an empowering voice for you. Now you're going to hear some stuff you won't hear or see anywhere else. We'll go to a break. We'll come back to Tucker Carlson interviewing the head of FEMA in Florida.
The person is Jared Moskowitz. He's the director of the Florida Division of Emergency Management, and we're happy to have him on tonight. Jared, thanks so much for coming on. So, simple question. Repeat for our audience, if you would, what you told me about your efforts to get masks for your state, which, by the way, is your job. What happened?
Yeah, no, thanks, Tucker. I appreciate you having me on. I appreciate you featuring this story. It's important for all the healthcare workers and nurses and doctors and first responders on the front line. Now, listen, for the last several weeks, we've had like a boiler room in our EOC chasing down 3M authorized distributors, brokers, supposedly representing that they sell N95 masks, only to get to warehouses that are completely empty, being told that our shipments are on cargo planes and the flights don't even appear on FlightAware. We're chasing ghosts, Tucker. And so, you know, I just decided to turn up the heat and tell people what is actually happening in the N95 mask space. And so, you know, 3M reached out to us today. Their government relations folks wanted to have a a conversation. And I thought perhaps maybe what 3M would finally say to me is that they have masks to sell me. But what I actually found out is even more frightening. It's what we suspected, which is that the system is completely broken, and that the authorized distributors, who right now can't tell me a timeline when I'm going to receive my masks orders that I put in a month ago. And by the way, the terms and conditions are, you know, I got to pay for the masks and can't cancel my order, is that 3M has lost total control. And so what I asked 3M is that, are they aware that their authorized distributors, U.S. companies, are telling me that the reason why our orders are being pushed down is because foreign countries are showing up with cash to purchase the orders. And when I told 3M that, not only did they not dispute it, I asked them if they've put out any guidance to prevent the behavior, and the answer was no. And so when I asked 3M, you know, what is your production? They said they're making 10 million masks a week. And when I said, great, I have money, I'd like to purchase some of those, they said I couldn't, that they have no mask to sell me. And this is, it's criminal what's happening, Tucker. And I want to say something very clear. This is not about the workers in the factories at 3M who are working 24 hours a day to try to create this life-saving PPE. This is about the executives who decided not to put America first, and it's going to have devastating consequences.
So just, I just want to encapsulate what you said, because I just want this to sink in for the audience. You try to get an answer. You're in charge of procuring these for the first responders in Florida. You're not some guy off the street. You're a government official trying to help a state that is becoming one of the centers of the outbreak, Florida. And you basically got the runaround. So you went after 3M on Twitter, and they responded. And people noticed it, and they responded. And you said, why can't I get it? And they basically said, we have no control. Our dealers are selling some of these masks to foreign countries because they got their first or they're paying cash. And you said, well, shouldn't you tell your distributors to make a priority for America, for the states, for the local governments, for first responders, physicians, nurses, EMTs? And they said, no, we haven't done that. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, not only is that a fair summary, it's exactly what's happening. It's why Governor DeSantis said the other day it's shady as hell, because that's exactly what it is. I mean, 3M is an ice cream store that doesn't sell ice cream, apparently. I mean, since when do we have a U.S. company who sells masks and I try to offer them money and they won't sell them to me? That, you know, I have to go through their authorized distributors. And their only excuse is that they don't have a perfect system. Well, that's great that they don't have a perfect system and that, you know, I'm relegated to make a deal.
Okay. You heard him say it. Think of all the people who are putting their lives at risk every single day. The bravest of the brave in the nurses, the medics, the police, the doctors, everyone involved. And we can't buy masks. We have the money. Take our money. Buy the masks. Give it to us. Nope. Tens of millions of masks. 10 million a week, and we've been doing this for quite some time. They're going to China and Germany and other places. Wow. Corporate greed. That's vulture capitalism at its most predatory and primal. I believe that the Justice Department should open an investigation into this. At the very least, we as a nation do have some power. Sell your stock in 3M. Let them know that this kind of selfishness with deadly consequences should not be tolerated in a society. Society is supposed to care about each other. You know, that's my own personal opinion. Now we're going to finish off the rest of our show. Evidently, the people are out doing journal writing and in different places. They're in their nature time now. We'll have... Huh? Oh, well, wait, we do have one on the line. Let's say hello to John. Hi, John.
Hi, Gary.
John, unrehearsed, I realized, please tell us what you've learned since being here this time.
Sure. Sure. The number one thing that I've learned, along with another things, is the silent ego. The strong ego, the vibrant ego like a Trump or a politician like Obama, who's very charming, or the football player who wears a lot of bling, or the Hollywood actor who is entitled and needs the red carpet all the time. That's that ego that's right out there, right in your face. The silent ego is the one that does a lot of things for people or is very self-critical of themselves and holds it in until they can't, and usually it comes out in a big burst. And I really identify with this because I've done it in my life. That's a major thing that I've learned here that really resonated with me. Something else that I've learned is that don't try to change people who won't show you by their actions that they want to change. They keep coming back to you, keep coming back for help and help and help, but don't do anything. Then they just suck you dry. And I have also been down that road. One of the other things I've learned that is the five harmonizing things you need what to change: the right place, the right time, the right idea, the right support system, the right time, can also be used in a negative way. And I don't mean to sound negative here, but you could put all those things together and build bombs, build ammunition, and go over and destroy countries like we've done. I found that fascinating, and I'm going to really pay attention to that and use that when I see things that are done in a harmful way. So I think those are the three major things that I've learned right now. I mean, there are others, but those are the three top.
Okay, well, thank you. I'll go into greater depth on the one, because I revealed that last night in a lecture, this whole new concept, which I'm not aware anyone's ever discussed. I'm not aware of it. Yep. I came up with this concept of exploring the hidden ego. Yep. And I'll go into great depth with that on probably on an upcoming Progressive Commentary Hour. John, thank you very much.
You're welcome,
for
Gary.
Coming on board.
Let me give you two, Susan.
Well, I can't now. Got to go to another thing. We'll ask Susan to be available on our next program.
Right.
All right. Now I want to get you into, and for all of our stations, I'm going to go up to the top of the hour, because this little segment you're going to hear is powerful, and, well, for many people, it could be one of those aha moments. You're going to hear now from that woman who I told you about earlier, Melanie Phillips, a British journalist, and a lifelong liberal, and she's talking about why I left the left. Now to that.
Can you explain what you think has happened to society since 1945?
Small question. I think that in the West, there's been a kind of cultural revolution that's gone on since 1945, since the end of the Second World War. And I think it very much actually has its roots in the war and the rise of Nazism and the Holocaust in the 30s and 40s, because I think what that did to Europe in particular, but to the West in general, was to deliver a kind of seismic shock to what the West thought of itself, because you had this unprecedented barbarism arising in the very heartland of high culture, Enlightenment reason, and it didn't take place in some benighted cultural backwater in some far-flung part of the world. It took place in the heart of Europe, and I think what that did was to give people a terrible impression, a terrible message, that this is what reason did, this is what the West did, this is what being a nation did, and so all those things became toxic and tainted. And I think that was a terrible mistake, personally, because what gave rise to Nazism and to anti-Semitism and to the Nazi Holocaust and to the war that followed was particular to a particular country at a particular time in history, governed by a particular set of circumstances, and prey to a particular set of prejudices. But nevertheless, I think there was a kind of cultural demoralization that set in the West. And as a result, it became very vulnerable to people who wanted to change Western society completely. And they came out of the Holocaust, they came out of Nazi-dominated Europe, and they were revolutionary Marxists, many of them. And they basically said, we did this, capitalism did this, the West did this, Enlightenment reason did this, and we now have a new society. And so that set in train a whole series of a whole set of thinking, which, because I think the West was demoralized, it was very receptive to these ideas, which basically involved overturning the basic tenets of Western civilization and the very idea of the Western nation state that embodied those concepts. So you had this great onslaught which took place progressively over the decades on the bedrock values of the West, transmitted through, for example, the traditional family, which became seen as the sort of epicenter of oppression, the onslaught on capitalism as a profoundly destabilizing and unfair doctrine, and the onslaught on education. Education is the transmission of a culture down through the generations, and I remember sitting through debates in the 80s and 90s in Britain, in which the received wisdom in the higher reaches of the education system was that you could not transmit the culture anymore down through the generations, because the culture was fundamentally rotten. It was fundamentally racist, it was white, it was colonialist, it was defined by colonialism, exploitation, capitalism. It had done down the poor at home and the benighted masses abroad, and consequently it needed to be completely revised and overthrown, and consequently you couldn't teach that to children. You had to teach them instead that they were born into a culture that was itself born in sin. And I remember those debates, and there was the people who objected to this as being ahistorical, false, malevolent, destructive, were just howled down as being, they would say that, wouldn't they? They are white, they are capitalist, they are the powerful. And so you had this destruction of the bedrock values of the West, and even more profoundly, you had a destruction, again, in the higher reaches of the universities, at the intelligentsia, you had the destruction of the very idea of truth itself, and this is how this worked. Again, arising from the experience of Nazi authoritarianism, Nazi totalitarianism, there arose a way of thinking which said any kind of external authority is authoritarian. It's an intrusion on our personal freedom and has to be resisted. The only thing that now matters, the only thing that counts, is how we ourselves create our own lives. So what matters more than anything else is how we believe ourselves to be. What I think matters more than what you think. You cannot tell me I am wrong, because my view is the same as your view. There's no hierarchy of views. There can be no hierarchy of opinion, of values, of culture. Nothing can be better or worse than anything else. No one's lifestyle can be better or worse than anyone else. No one's family background can be better or worse than anyone else. No one's national culture or religion can be better or worse than anyone else. If you say that it is better or worse than anyone else's, then you're racist. So as a result, liberal society could no longer say that it was better than illiberal society. We could no longer say it was better, objectively better, to have a society based on ideas of equality between men and women, freedom of religion, and all the rest of it, because that was racist, because it distinguished us from those countries which didn't have that. So what mattered was how I felt was what was true. What I feel myself to think, what I feel, and my feelings, my emotions, are more important than any facts. Because I create my own reality. And as a result of that, you had an erosion of the idea of objective truth. Objectivity went out the window. You couldn't have objectivity. You couldn't have rules of evidence. You couldn't have any rules. What I say is true as what you say is true. It's all relative. And consequently, the world, as recreated along these lines, no longer understood the difference between truth and lies. And consequently, it accepted lies as truth. It was even worse than this, because in this great drive to get rid of any kind of external authority. Biblical morality, of course, went out the window. Biblical morality was regarded as a grotesque intrusion onto personal freedom. And also it was based on the Bible, and who cared about the Bible? It was all magical, superstitious, mumbo-jumbo, only believed by idiots and imbeciles. That's what we've been told for the last half century. And so biblical morality went out, and in came man-made morality, which was basically ideology, the power of the idea. And these ideologies were all basically designed to produce a kind of perfect world. They would get rid of prejudice from the human heart. They would prevent war from ever happening again. They would prevent Nazism from ever again stalking the corridors of free societies. They would produce a brotherhood of man. And consequently, they couldn't brook any opposition because they were all designed to better humanity in their own lights. And consequently, anyone who said there was anything wrong with any of them was somebody who wasn't just wrong-headed. They were somebody, by definition, who did not want to better humanity. So they weren't just wrong, they were evil. And so if somebody came along and said, you know, I don't think it's necessarily right that the West invented slavery. In fact, the West, everyone had slavery at one time. And in fact, Britain and America were the pioneers of getting rid of slavery. This is historical fact. But it goes against the ideology, which says, you know, white people are intrinsically bad. And consequently, those facts could not be admitted as facts. And anyone who said them was, by definition, evil, because they were people who were against the whole anti-racist idea that only white people could be racist and all that. And consequently, you had a situation arising, which we're living through, having sown the wind, we're reaping the whirlwind through identity politics, victim culture, woke stuff, and all that, in which the power of the idea was absolute. It could not be gainsaid. And consequently, anyone who opposed it had to be treated as somebody who had to be shut down as being evil. And it's an amazing thing that in getting rid of biblical religion, what we've done by substituting man-made ideologies is produce something that's very, very similar to the very worst excesses of medieval religions. You have a dogma, you have a catechism. The dogma cannot be challenged. It must be enforced. Anybody who opposes it is a heretic who must be burned at the stake. Now, we don't burn people physically at the stake anymore, but we burn them in other ways. We deprive them of their livelihoods. We prevent them from being promoted. We prevent them from having their friends. We treat them as social pariahs and outcasts, and that's what we've done. So it's very, very similar to the medieval inquisitions produced by the Catholic Church, and then on through the French Revolution and subsequent secular revolutions, communist totalitarianism, and then fascism. We're reproducing those totalitarian cultures in a secular form, and on the basis that this is supposed to produce a better world, a freer world, a kinder, gentler world, in response to all those terrible things that happened in the past. We've gone full circle.
Okay, something to think about. We will have a discussion on this and the second part of the interview on our next program. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.